A forum is different from the other sessions. I know, like, in a lot of the sessions there's a lot of discussion, but the forum is specifically set aside for everyone to participate. That's is stories, questioner, statements. It's open. And today, though, we have three experts. We have three people to start off, and also to sort of field your questions. One is Bill Erbrock, who's here on the teaching staff, the far end. He's the one leading the Bible studies this week. And the other is Susan Kyle, who is a Holden Village pastor and involved in an education before she became a pastor. And Carol Nolte, who is a pastor, LCA pastor in...
ALC.
I always thought you were LCA. Mistake. But anyway, she's from Santa Monica, California, and she used to teach English for quite a few years before she became a pastor. So they're all involved, have been involved with education and with languaging and the power of images and words and how they form what we think and enlarge what we think and also constrict what we think. And I've asked each one of them to sort of start off with either a personal little story or anecdote or something that relates to image or language in relationship to created in whose image.
There's a test that you identify
yourself. Oh, I'm Janet Anderson. And this is Carol, you want to start?
Yeah, I think I have three very short stories that I'd share with you just to show you perhaps some of the process of coming to awareness that language is a problem when it comes to biblical translations and the whole feminist cry in the church. The first, my home pastor for many years, on Father's Day, had all the men stand in the church and sing "Rise Up, O Men of God." Precisely the reason why that hymn has changed, and I'm glad that it's been changed. That's a little thing in my past that really irritated me.
How has it changed?
It's now "Rise Up, O Saints of God." Secondly, after 14 years of teaching English in Los Angeles City Schools, I left the country and taught school for 2 years in New Guinea. And when I came back, the country was considerably changed. You'd be surprised how much things change in 2 years. And I had a different kind of class when I came back. And I can remember very vividly the day that I faced my class, my English class, and I said, in good grammar, would everyone please bring his books over here? And only the boys got up. And I said, would everyone, come on, girls. And they said, you only said boys. And it was at that point that I finally figured out that it wasn't just a matter of sort of fine-tuning their grammar, but it was a matter of if I was going to communicate with them, I was going to have to change. That was a great turning of a corner in my life as an English teacher and as a woman in the church, because it began to make some connections with things that I've lived in the church. And then one little anecdote from seminary was that before the LBW came out, my first year at seminary, we were still in the SBH. And we had communion every Wednesday. The Nicene Creed was said, and this is one I think that many women have been sensitive to, but the men in the seminary would shout, "Who for us men?" And that gave me a real clue that it was fine for them to say, it means, men means all of us, but when it really came down to it, it only meant them. And so that was one of the, kind of the coming of awareness that language is extremely important in the way we think. And I've since come a long, long way in dealing with language problems, and I have a couple of grammars, they're rhetoric teachers at UCLA in my congregation, and we have had any number of conversations, and now I see that almost all of the problems, I think, are a matter of translation. And we can talk a little bit about translation problems. That is, it has to do with grammatical gender versus natural gender, and whether or not our English language is losing its grammatical gender. So that's
okay.
Susan? I thought I would take it from experience, not so much with the language itself, but with just experience of being a woman and a pastor in a parish, and just tell a couple of stories. Prefacing that with having had some conversation while I was at seminary with a woman who was working on her PhD in education, who was very emphatic that children are not able to think abstractly, at least before age 8. So that language for them is exactly the way they read it. And one of the first 6 months in the parish, I was a woman brought her child to church for the first time, and her child was 3 or 4. And I just had a permanent the day before, so I was really curly hair. This little girl said to her mother, "Mommy, God has curly hair." And what she had associated was that her mom had told her that they were going to God's house. And I know it's true from my experience in the past that children have looked at male pastors and seen Jesus, especially male pastors with beards. No, that's Jesus. And little children do that. And she really thought, she connected that I was God because she was in God's house and I was the only one doing anything, so I must be God, right?
And she had no problem with it.
No. And the other thing came out of that parish also was that I was the second woman pastor. I followed a woman. So there was a whole generation of children who had not experienced a man as a pastor. This little girl was one. And then there was an overnight with the Sunday school when a 10-year-old boy said, "Do you think that if God had another child, that this time it would be a girl?" And that came out of, that was not prompted. It wasn't pushing for that. I don't even think we were talking about God at that particular point. But it just occurred to him that with having, his whole life he had women pastors, it sort of made sense to him, I think. God needed to be represented by a female. And we didn't get into arguments about images for God and changing the language and making God a female. It just happened for them because they were experiencing God in the form, the image of a woman. And that's been really significant to me in terms of how I then began to understand and to fight for more inclusive language for the image of God, because as they grow up and have to deal in more abstract terms, if the language remains the same as it is now, they're going to be confused, and I would like not to see that happen.
Okay, Bill?
Next time you see that little girl, Sue, set her straight. God does not have curly hair. God is bald. Well, one of my interests is that language is not merely spoken. There are all sorts of languages that go on even while we speak, or when we're not speaking. Some of us come out of cultures where we learn not to do too much, at least with our hands. I was raised in an Italian neighborhood in Chicago when I was a boy, and I remember always being fascinated by my neighbors who did not talk the way that any of us in our family or among my relatives talked. Ostensibly, they spoke English the way we spoke English, but it wasn't the same kind of English at all. And I can't even begin to show you what they did when they were speaking English. It was nothing like when we spoke English. It was very different. And I've been very aware over the years, I guess, I don't know if it's part of my constitution or because I trained myself for this, but to all sorts of things that are on what we sometimes consider the fringes of language. And so I'm very interested in form and color and the way we communicate besides just in the spoken word. And one of the experiences that I've had over the years that I remember having a rather profound impact on me, if you want to move it over towards some religious language or imaging the divine. When I was small, my parents used to always take me to German service. There was such a thing in Virginia in those days. This was in Chicago, at Gethsemane Evangelical Lutheran Church, Huatse. That means Bund für Endete Augsburgische Konfession. And I remember our minister, he's a very tall gentleman. His name was Reverend Eichstedt. He had a deep, booming voice. He wore a black gown. He looked like a presence, during the whole service. And of course, I heard this strange language. Now, I heard my parents speak this at home once in a while when they didn't want me to get what was going on. And I also always heard them speak it with my grandma and grandpa whenever they visited. And I always sat in the corner and just listened to all this going on. And there was one word in German that I knew. It was the word Punkt. Because it was always used in conversation. Someone would get very animated, not in the Italian way, but in the North German way, which means every once in a while you raise an eyebrow. To make the point of the conversation, they would say, Punkt. And I sort of knew that meant end of this segment, next person will talk. I didn't quite know. In church, I also knew one word. It was the word capital. And I used to wait every Sunday to listen to the capitals. I used to think the capitals were a lot of fun.
What does capital mean?
Capital means chapter.
Yeah.
And the minister was always referring to capitals. But all of this, it was, in my own way, I was being inducted into it was obviously something unusual. It was important, evidently, to my parents. It was in a language that was foreign to me, but it was expected that somehow it was going to touch me. It wasn't all unlike what happened to all of my neighbors in the block, who, if they were Italian, went that way to St. Mary of Mount Carmel on Sunday, or if they were Irish, went that way to St. Justin on Sunday. But in either event, they heard the priest speak in a language that they didn't know either. And all of this language, somehow or other, also centered around that great black presence who at the end of the service would rise over all of us and in this wonderful deep voice of his would stand up and he would go,
Der Herr, lass leuchten sein Angesicht über dich und sei dir gnädig. Der Herr erhebe sein Angesicht auf dich und gebe dir Frieden.
And Mrs. Simon, sitting right behind us, would respond, Amen! Amen!
And everybody said, there goes Mrs. Simon. And at the end of the service, we all filed past him and shook hands with him. You know, this man, he deigned. Dames to shake hands with little Billy. The languages that were being spoken there were really overpowering. If you don't mind me finishing the story with one other thing. I also remember that during communion, this was obviously something really big. It didn't happen all the time. But when it did, there was a point in the service when all the adults got down on the floor like this, my dad.
Right there. I was very impressed. My parents never did that for anybody but God. And something big was going on. Imagine what a change this was for me when we went into all the great liturgical reforms and ministers started wearing white. As it turned out, I really welcomed the change. But what a change in images. And then, of course, to go from German to English and all the rest of it. I don't know what that proves. It certainly is an experience out of my own life with language and trying somehow or other to project meaning and a presence into this little kid who couldn't speak a word of German and who didn't know all that much of what was going on except for the little cards he used to get out of Cradle Roll.
Are there any other stories that you remember from your childhood or even recently as far as images or languaging that either have been funny or very serious to you but have created a feeling within you as regarding the image of God? It's kind of hard to just plop it in your lap like that.
Well, someone's got to top my story.
Well, this isn't a topper. This is below. But I just remember going to seminary and hearing there was sort of a commitment to using inclusive language seminary, and getting used to hearing inclusive language. And then going back to my home congregation where it was not used and suddenly hearing what I had never heard before and suddenly feeling excluded in a way that I had never felt before, and knew then how really important it was. And would not have, I mean, intellectually I could have said, well, yes, inclusive language ought to be used, and so on and so on and so on, but the experience was just overwhelming, and it did not hit me. What hit me when I first went to seminary and heard it, and heard things that, and we were still using the Red Book, but they were using inclusive language and so on. Like, oh my, this is a, oh, that's so nice, you know, that sort of thing. Not until I got this overwhelming experience was going back to exclusive.
So it was a juxtaposition of actually jumping back to something and you hadn't even really noticed it before.
I might say that as an English teacher, one of the things that I found with other English teachers and people who are concerned about the language, we tend to be conservative. I mean, we tend to be protectors of the language. And it takes longer to convert an English teacher.
To
inclusive language, because you find yourself kind of defending it. And then when it hits, it kind of tumbles us more than the next person.
He asked stories about how children see things, and I heard one story. I don't know whether this story is going around a lot, but I heard this from my stepmom. In teaching Sunday school, the kids were drawing their impressions of different scenes. And one kid brings up, and of course you wouldn't criticize the children, so but tell me about who this is and so forth. So one guy has this plane with these people in it, and he says, well, what's that? And that, well, that's the flight from Egypt. And so tell me about the people, and there's Jesus, and there's Mary, and the baby Jesus, and who's this, and that was Pontius the Pilot. but the real clincher was, it's true, is this fat guy standing around in the back with this big smile, and they said, well, who is that? And he said, that was Round John Virgin.
that's not really so far off base, because I bet all of us have had that experience. My sister for years thought that this famous hymn that all Lutherans sing was "A mighty fortress is our God, a dusty shield and weapon." She sang that for years.
Well, the one hymn of "Gladly the cross I bear," a lot of kids think that's "Gladly the cross I bear." I mean, bringing in the sheets.
I have another remembrance besides this, the great black presence, the great ministerial presence for God, and that was the very first, and as it is now, I think the only Sunday school teacher I remember. And I really would like to affirm her name. Her name was Nellie Heitner. It just came to me now. She was a marvelous woman. And I remember one Easter, she gave me an Easter bunny. And I just thought that was one of the greatest things that ever happened to me. And I was still in correspondence with her when she was in an old folks home at the age of about 95 and still working at making ceramics and things and still giving things away to people. And so that was my, I think, my feminine presence of God, besides, of course, my parents, which are probably closest to all people. But there was a sort of like a balance to the great ministerial presence. It was the presence of Nellie. And they were living, you know, words.
Well, I'm a PK, and I had my own share of Godfather Black Rope syndromes attached to that situation. But I think that gave me a unique vantage point and sense of God the Creator in the duality of male and female that oftentimes I miss in this kind of a dialogue or any, you know, with the issue of whether God is male or female and finding exclusive polarization on a point. And I think in my own experience that my mother's expression of faith, my father's expression of faith were incomplete without each other. My mother was, as I used to chide her, being my father's assistant pastor and social calendar organizer, while my father, you know, they subdivided the tasks of presenting and imaging God to their congregations. And so in my more mature years, I've become to realize that those interdependencies of the creative power of the image of God, male and female, but it is both male and female, and how to express duality in terms of personal language is a real problem. I sense it, and I work now as a parish physician in the Catholic parish, where you would want to find a personal pronoun that the English language does not have that would be not just a loose we or a collective statement, but that would be a real you. That would have implied male and female specifically. It's almost like the language is deficient for the thought that we're trying to collect. And I was wondering if English teachers here or the pastors here have any progressive thought.
I think that the problem first is simply language, not God language. That's a specialized. I mean, that's a bigger. Maybe it's a bigger problem. I think the real problem is the question that is being asked in the grammatical service now, and I'm not a linguist, but I have one in my congregation. And that is are we losing grammatical gender? Because the English language has lost almost all the grammatical gender, and the few places where it shows up are places like ships or she's and, you know, things like that. But our language does not have very much grammatical gender left. Now the question is, have we lost even that which we still remember a little bit of? And if we have, what's called for is a retranslation of all kinds of things, not just the translation from the French. Say if you're going to have a modern translation of a French novel or of a German novel, you'd redo it. You'd have a modern translation. But somehow or other, since it's already translated into English, and we never think about redoing it. Well, we're thinking about it now, but that comes more slowly. And we have people that are hanging on to it. And I think that's the first question. And the second thing that I try to tell people that I run into with tremendous resistance is that, especially if they're pastors, is to say, if you would acknowledge the fact that it's a translation problem at all, then you're faced with what you're about is the proclamation of the gospel. And what if the vast majority of your congregation aren't hearing you? And then it really is in your ballpark. I mean, if you're going to hang on to purity of language over against proclamation of the gospel and making some kind of communication, you're really being stupid, I think. And even, I mean, I've had some of my older women come and say, well, it doesn't bother them, But then I remind them that there are a few young people in there, and it does bother them, and so it's important that we do something about bridging that gap of communication. And they seem to be a little bit less reluctant to allow for that openness.
I think you bring up an important problem, and that is, too, you know, how much intentionality does a language, you know, stand intentional change?
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, most of the change in language comes about rather unintentionally.
Yeah.
On the other hand, we're not without examples of intentional changes. I mean, someone discovered the alphabet in the middle of the second millennium in Canaan. And there it was a new discovery, and gave it to other people, and they followed. Modern Hebrew was intentionally, you know, put together out of a resurrection of part of ancient Hebrew and all kinds of neologisms, and it worked. I mean, there are occasions when you can do that intentionally. And I certainly did that 5 or 10 years ago. I simply told myself one day, okay, from now on, every time I hear myself saying him or his in class, the next time I'll say her or hers. And I simply made it the intention of one time one time the next. Now I'm at the point where I do it unintentionally. Sometimes I'll say his, sometimes I'll say hers, whichever.
Well, also along, just in, if you think about in society, words that become coined that everyone gets to know, you know, make the cover of Time magazine, that go with wherever, I don't know who coins them, if it's the news media or something, and everyone sort of understands this new meaning for this word. And they become popular words, and sometimes they even make it past the couple years when they're popular. So that, in a sense, is not really unintentional, but it's somewhere in between, too. One of the things that, for me, when I was a senior in when I was a senior in college, one of the things that you had to do, I guess somebody had to do it, but I had to do is I had to preach a sermon at chapel on one of the days that I went to CLC. And I don't know why I did, I don't know where it came from, but it came out of me, and I was talking mainly about not saying creeds, not singing songs, not saying anything unless you really believe it. Lots of times we just go to church and we just mouth the words and we're not even thinking about what we're saying. And my little sermon I wrote back then as a senior in college was a call to the other students and to myself to say, hey, really think about what you're saying. And so because I did this through the years since then, I've watched myself. You know, I'll be reading a creed or saying something or hearing someone else language something, and all of a sudden I say, hey, I don't agree to this, or I don't believe this, or this isn't the way I'd say it. And it got to the place in the liturgy where I was not saying much at all because I didn't identify with the language, or somehow it didn't sit right. And it was getting very upsetting to me because I wanted to participate, but within me it wasn't feeling like my language and my words. And so I sort of backed into the whole thing about languaging, not intending anything about questioning it, just saying, you know, is this the way I would say it? Is this what I really believe? And so I think it's not just the feminism thing, it's language itself. We've got a lot of competition. Shall we go next door? This is, it sounds like they're having a great time.
Yeah.
Oh, I know. That's
they're crazy.
They're learning out. They're hearing what kind of persons they are. Can I see? Well, anyway, so I think there are a lot of us that have thought about words, and in some ways, I would bet there are people in this room who the words haven't bothered them at all. And maybe yet. But maybe, you know, those of you who feel that way, it would be good to hear from you and to have you. You know, I don't want you to feel that this is a slanted discussion. If you say, hey, I feel really comfortable. I have no problem with the words at all. I fit in it. It fits what I believe. I don't think that that's an atypical position. It may be atypical at Holden, but I don't think in the church at large.
I often wonder about the visual images for children. I teach in a Lutheran school that's 90% black. And all the pictures of Jesus are of this Caucasian looking.
Blue-eyed woman.
And, you know, what is the image of God to them? You know? How do they stand? They can't.
Last week, Dan Erlander showed some slides from, I think it was last week, from Namibia at the seminary there, and some of the tapestries and the paintings, and all the figures, Christ and the disciples and everyone, they were black. And it was really neat to see. The artwork was just gorgeous. And I would bet that that kind of identification.
Now, I think in the same token, we're talking about masking. Sometimes it surprises me, although I understand some of the reasons for it, we can understand the necessity, you know, we can, like an Asian child or a black child or an adult, whatever, that God needs, they need to see themselves reflected. They need to see themselves in God's image, and if they are black, that means black. So too, female. I think it's terribly, terribly important, not that, and this is my own personal opinion, not just that we be inclusive about God, I think it's terribly, terribly important that we be able to say God, she. Not God, he and she, not God neutral, not God nurtured, God, she, as well as God, he. Not that I was saying we exclude God, he, but we've had he for centuries and centuries. And I like your creator whose image, how am I? And I know all the intellectual answers, but if God is male, how am I created in God's image?
Well, that links up with the comment up here.
Exactly. But for the same reason that the black person needs to image God, and we recognize it's an image.
Right.
And blackness, or the Asian person, Asian, and so on. So the female, female.
Somehow or other, there's more worry about a cultural picturing, but not female picturing.
There's less worry, you mean?
I mean we're more concerned that there be African art that shows an African Jesus.
And what does it say?
Why don't we worry as much about?
What does it say about our investment? And then the next question I ask, you know, what does it say about our cultural investment in God as he? We do not have the same kind of investment in God as black or God as Asian as we do in God as he, because the resistance is so strong.
Well, it seems to me that let's try something daring. The tradition that we've got, especially among Christians, and particularly among fairly conservative Christians, as most Lutherans happen to be, you know, the tradition weighs so heavily in that direction. You know, this morning in the biblical studies group, Phyllis Tribble was helping us find some metaphors in the scriptures that describe God in feminine ways. But, you know, you have to sort of look for them. You certainly don't have to look for the images that present the God in masculine ways. I mean, they're all over the place. They obviously predominate overwhelmingly. So it would appear to me that, you know, the tradition tends to tell us rather powerfully, you've got to stick with these images. Now, try something a little more daring, though, at least for the sake of discussion. And that's this question about, you know, picturing the God, say, as black, as an African, or picturing the God, the Divine One, as being female. It leads to the question here, you see, it's not only created in whose image, but who's creating whom in whose image? You know that old that old saw that's all about, is it really that we're created in God's image, or is it really the fact that we're always creating God in our image? And then you get this nice, cute little answer from the Barthians, you know, everything else is religion. All the religions of the world, it's the humans creating God in their image. But there's only one true faith, that's the one where the God creates us in God's image. And that's, you know, the only one in the scripture. But try something like this. If indeed the God has poured out the God's own spirit on us, and if indeed the God is inviting us to take part in the new creation and in the creative process as new beings, then what is so fearful about creating the God in our image? Are we not simply in in an incredible transaction, the God having given the Spirit to us, the Spirit now creates the images of the God? Isn't that the same God working, but working in a different way? And wouldn't that remind us in some sense that beyond all those images, anyway, is that ultimate ineffable one that transcends, finally? But it's that old Zen problem of, the first thing you looked at was my finger. You didn't look at the light that I was pointing at.
I'm thinking that the printing press caused us a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
Because prior to that time, word was something that sort of was in the air. You spoke it and it was out there. And some people wrote it down, but most people never knew how to read it. And then once we had it there and on paper, we got so literal that that little piece of print there, the ink on the paper, becomes the thing. And as soon as we put God, He, on paper, it was like, that's official, folks. You can't think of it in any other way. Because it was tangible. You could look at it, you could hold it, you could tear it up, you could burn it, you could do anything. And so sound and language in terms of sound changed and became a very literal experience. Then we get scared. Well, we don't know. Can we really talk? Can we really look at our translations now? Can we go back to the Greek and put it the way the Greek meant it to be? I mean, after all, it's been in English now, on paper.
I think we have to. We're going to make sense. Meanings change. I mean, meanings have changed in my lifetime for other kinds of words. And why are we so presumptuous to think that the language of the Bible somehow stays set in concrete forever?
I think it's
what
really...
What about the translation of the word image then? Are we sure that we mean exactly like him? Can we not believe in a God whose thoughts are greater than our thoughts? And personally, I've never tried to say exactly what he looked like. To me, it's not terribly important. I think he's far beyond. When you think of the constellations, television, all the things that are around that we accept and don't understand, then we decide, boy, now does he look black and white? How he looks, are we really getting beyond our realm? God is God. He's a great God.
But is he
of them?
Well, I don't know why he is. He's a great power. I'm using the word he. That's not thinking of it. Not seeing a particular apparition, but it's a man.
Could you say she's a great power?
I think that I don't see him as either one, particularly. I don't see God as a man or as a woman. I mean,
so is it grammatical gender, or is it?
When you start trying to decide my little mind with God, it's like...
The question was an important question, though.
Yeah, it is.
And she's putting you on the spot. You need to affirm your nervousness, because I think a lot of the rest of us feel that way. Would you feel just as comfortable going back to what you just said and say, she's a great God, she's way beyond us, her thoughts are not our thoughts?
Sure.
Since I don't picture him.
And I would think, wouldn't I could have black people think that he's black and then have them go to that country where he came from and say, well, how could he be black?
So should it be a strategy that maybe we try that in the church some Sunday and make all the language of God female language? And maybe to make some of the scientists among us happy, or some of those like myself who very often don't even think in male and female terms for God, could we use some energy language some Sunday? God.
Sort of as an
expanding energy.
Do you really think him as a male or a female?
Well, the thing that I think they're saying is, they can respond to it, but that if you really take seriously that you're using that language, you'd say, I believe God is more than male and female. But as long as you continue to use a certain language form, you are limiting your own experience. And so it's sort of like saying, well, try something else on. If you really do believe God is more than, then what would be wrong with trying this? And that is just sort of almost a belief extender rather than a constrictor. Did any of you want to speak to you?
I did a little experiment once with people, and really, I was surprised at what kind of an impact it had. And I was getting at images of God, and I used a sentence prayer, oh God, and then I put a blank. Help me in my time of need. And then I asked people to close their eyes, and I would fill in that word, in that blank, oh God, comforter, help me in my time of need, oh God, rock of life, help me in my time of need, oh God, mother, oh God, I even used things like bar of soap, you know, I used all kinds of images, and afterwards, I asked people to respond to what happened to them in that experience. And what they verified was, it had a tremendous impact on their experience of God and of the prayer. In other words, what they affirmed was, the image you use for God affects the experience you have of God. That when you say, oh God, rock of my being, help me in my time of need, you have one kind of image of God. When you say, oh God, lover of my soul, you have another experience.
I guess I would still argue that, you know, there are certain images which attain pride of place. When we went through this, I forget if it was yesterday morning, we were going through various images for God in the scriptures, and we were fiddling around with the theme here for the summer, under the shadow of God's wings. And those of you who are there, please correct me if I make a mistake in presenting this, because I want to get it right. But there are all kinds of responses from people who said, well, they imaged God, when they heard under the shadow of God's wings, they thought of an eagle, or they thought of a mother hen, there were all sorts of bird images. And finally, one person said, well, what about an airplane? Those are wings. And the immediate response from people was, no, that won't work. It has to be more human. There's not enough warmth there. And somehow or other, the animal images were sort of human.
Well, they're alive.
See, at least they're alive. The airplane didn't quite work. And then I surprised everybody when I said, but if we had all been ancient Near Easterners, perhaps the first thing that would have come to our mind was of the sun, because the sun was pictured as having wings. But the images, certain images have pride of place, and those images which are like and animate images, I guess, and particularly male-female images, personal images, end up with pride of place.
I'm saying the same thing, the image makes a difference.
Well, yeah. Sure. I preached on the text of the brood hen, and in my congregation it's a very small congregation, I have one veterinarian. And I used that image of God as a brood hen. And on Monday morning, the vet called me up and said, you know, I've been thinking about that all day, and I think that's a wonderful thing. Well, it's nice to be affirmed by a vet. But it made a lot of sense to him, and I thought that was a neat affirmation.
Well, I was just going to throw out, what about Christological references? What about references to Jesus, who had specific gender? I think, and, you know, you were leading us to the Spirit. I find myself in my own images of God, leading the female images connecting to God the Creator and God the Spirit. But I have real trouble, and maybe this is the loss of coming out, with exclusively female images replacing the male image of Christ. And I'm sure there are probably some people here who really think that is, or should, you know, is an appropriate replacement. But I must admit that I have difficulty with that, and I was wondering if any of you had experiences with that issue in your own prayer life or your own communities.
Do any of the three of you want to respond to that?
Well, yeah, I've struggled with that a lot. I don't have it resolved.
But one of the things that I've had to do for myself, this isn't a very big step, I don't think, but when Jesus says, you know, pick up your cross and follow me, if Jesus is talking to me, then if I want to take that literally, that means I have to be able to image myself carrying that cross. Mm-hmm. And I also have to image myself being nailed to that cross. Mm-hmm. And the problem I have with them, this is, you know, is that as a woman, it is so hard to see that, to imagine somebody doing that to me. And on the other hand, you know, there's a sense that women experience that all the time, but not for any glorious kind of reason. You know, it's not a sacrifice they choose. It's a sacrifice that keeps getting chosen for them, matters and abusive people. But it's not an unusual place for a woman to be, but it's just so hard for me to imagine that I would be allowed to do that. Did you?
Yeah, well, in both of the, there are two inclusive language lectionaries that have tried to do something about that. And if anybody can remember the specific rule, help me out here. I think that what they tried to do was to avoid repeating the male pronoun as often as they do, because it is sort of overwhelming. You just get bombarded with the male pronoun, both in human language and in God language. So they've cut that down by repeating, for instance, instead of saying Jesus he, they'll say Jesus, and then they'll use the word Christ or some other word for Jesus, instead of saying for him. There are some rules of thumb that they've gone by. They have the most bothersome one, and I have to admit, it's bothersome to me, and I don't know what to do with it, is when you get the technical language of Son of Man, which has all kinds of theological meanings. They've translated that differently. Child of God, I think. Do you remember? Does anybody remember what it is? Child of God, and that really I don't know what to do with it. But I don't like Son of Man anymore. I mean, it's because that's been loaded up with theological and technical stuff that once you know that, you're so proud of the fact that you know it, see, that you don't want to change. But there's years and years of tradition that go with that. And so I think that most of the rules of the Inclusive Language Lectionary are simply that they're going to cut down on the numbers of references to the male pronoun, but also that when it refers to Jesus and the specific reference is to his maleness,
for his parts, that you have to include Jesus' personhood as being male.
Yeah, but they'll also talk a lot, use the word humanity or personhood and things like that. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I maybe coming at it from another way that I've tried to do with it, because I've been in trouble too, is if you start thinking about humans and males becoming more fully human by, in some senses, in our language would be more developing the feminine side or the right and left brains, or becoming more of a total person, and saying that if we use Jesus as an image, that if you read some of the things about his person, he was a very full person. And if we can, coming at it from another way, redefine what it means to be male in a more whole type person, then it's not as oppressive to me to see him as in that way. Does that make sense?
Is it really the fact that there's not a single Roman Catholic in the audience tonight?
I am.
You see, it appears to me, I was just chuckling at myself because it just came to me that, you know, Protestants especially get themselves into an incredible bind here, because they have no human counterpart. God the Son, in terms of the, you know, Trinitarian language, surely is not male. The eternal Logos? but was incarnated in a man. But the obvious solution to only having an incarnation in a male that has clearly been worked out in Christian tradition is that next to Jesus, you have his Blessed Mother.
Right.
But Protestants can never quite work that one out.
Right.
And it may be because there have been certain excesses, as Protestants see it, in the way Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox have worked it out. But my feeling has been for many years that there's a secret that those people know that the rest of us have lost.
Yeah, I agree. I really do. I've heard priests preach on for the ordination of women on the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. I mean, that would hurt lots of Lutheran brains. Or the little one-liners where Mary shows up in Scripture at Pentecost. For instance, and then the new type, the honor of Mary given as the generator and regenerator of the form of
image. I guess I just feel very nervous about trying to turn Jesus into an hermaphrodite.
I wasn't saying that either.
But I don't even want to get close to that. And I think a more helpful way and to be faithful to the tradition of the Church Universal, clearly to my mind, the more healthy way is to get at the job of really dialoguing about the place and significance of the Blessed Mother.
Marina Warner wrote a book, Alone of All Her Sex, and she, well, it's quite a lot. But one of the things she says in there that, in fact, that the place of Mary did not get put to such a great acknowledgement by the Roman Catholic Church till it was politically important to do, because the people in their own belief hung on to female images when there was conversion and so on, that they kept hanging on to this. And in order for the Catholic Church to keep its power, they had to expand their view themselves and include Mary, because the people wanted her. The people felt a need of a feminine image, and which is an interesting way to see how in past times there are things that are enlarged.
I'm wondering that if Jesus walked in this room right now, he would be very interested in this discussion, because Jesus is a full person and he does have the answers to these questions, and I'm sure we'll find them out when we meet him. But I come to it from a question of who would walk up to him and call him my Lord and be able to wash his feet? Who in this room would be able to do that? And I'm just curious to see who would have a problem doing that.
I don't exactly know what you're asking.
In recognizing whether God is he or she, looking at Jesus as God's child and worshiping him, and where I feel we're in an intellectual approach to God right here in this room, and it's worthwhile. But there's another question that I think that I would just like to hear addressed on how we would meet him right now, because that's the act of faith.
Are you saying that you feel that by straighten out what you're saying. By talking in this way and discussing this way, somehow it demeans the idea of your understanding of belief, and that, in a sense, this is taking away from one's faith? Or are you challenging everyone in this room to really just consider this, that there's another aspect? I'm not exactly sure what you're...
I think that there comes the intellectual approach to faith and questioning belief in your mind. And in Scripture it says, God is bigger than the mightiest intellect, and he is more powerful than the weakest one among us, or more powerful than the most powerful one. God is everything. I mean, God is magnificent. And if we look at God from an intellectual standpoint, we stay intellectual with him, and we have to wrestle with the male, female, the black, white. But if we approach it from a heartfelt and from our faith, actively looking at God as a person, not God as a person
I don't know what he looks like or what God looks like. I use the word he because I've never even thought about the she. I know that God is in spirit, is not male nor female. It says it in the scriptures. He's not Jew or free man. He's God is God. But Jesus is who God gave us so we can understand the character, the loving character of God. And that question leads me to ask, would we be able to walk up? Who would be able to walk up and say, my Lord?
I'm not sure this is going to answer that. I'd like to respond in part, though, that Jesus, to me, is present now in this room. And that if I understand the incarnation, that I am at least a part of that incarnation. And that as I encounter people, I am encountering the Christ. And, and I've experienced that in relationships with other human beings, both male and female. Therefore, I don't know that I expect anymore that Jesus, the man who walked the streets of Nazareth and Jerusalem, is the physical person that is going to enter into. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I believe in the return of Jesus, but I don't know I don't understand how that happens, and it's really not significant to me how that happens, because I already have experienced the risen Christ in my relationships with other people, and that is a part of who I am.
Judy, you had your hand up too in relation.
I'd like to hear what Carol says.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just going to respond that what I'm trying to say, and I think a lot of people have said it, is also that language informs both the way we think and the way we feel. And so it's important to struggle with this question. It isn't that we're saying, oh, you know, I've got to figure out if Jesus is just a man or whatever, or that God is both male and female. It isn't that we have to figure that out first before we worship. We worship the triune God. We worship God in a whole lot of ways, but the language that we use to worship informs our faith, allows us a greater expression, and it seems to me that every one of us here ought to be concerned about expanding our options of communicating the gospel. I mean, that really is important to us, should be. So even if you're not as far along as somebody else, I got a long way to go to understand a whole bunch of things about language, but I want to try and grasp that. And then to realize that society is, the language is always changing, whether we want it to or not. So we better keep up and figure out how to communicate with people. That's where I see the importance.
And I respond to? Oh, go ahead.
No. Judy and then Bill, or Bill and then Judy, either one.
I guess I would just say in that regard, too, if Jesus walked in the room, I agree with Susan. As we understand the incarnation of Jesus is present already. And but anyway, even if Jesus were to walk in the room, what I would experience Jesus is that he would accept me more fully than I have been accepted perhaps in any other way, any other time. And that one of the things Jesus most often did was take the establishment of language and pattern and tradition and ritual and say to it, open up and look, it's bigger.
Yeah, yeah.
I take women as daughters as much as I take men as sons.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I've got a couple of responses. The one is that if I really feel that we've got a lot to learn from our Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox brethren and sisters, brothers and sisters. I think we also have a lot to learn from our Jewish brothers and sisters. And when I say that, I don't just mean that as, you know, something you're supposed to say. I'm quite convinced that they are part of God's family right now. And in the Jewish tradition, there's one rather interesting set of stories that I always enjoy, and that is that it's said that on occasion, Moses and Elijah will come back to visit.
fact, there's even one of those visits recorded in the Christian scriptures. And but usually they don't visit on mountains. They usually visit in the classroom. It's their favorite place of visiting. And the reason they enjoy the visit so much, and particularly Moses, is because of the incredible discussions that are developed on Torah. And it's not unknown that on occasion Moses will go to the Holy One, blessed be he, Jewish language, and say, what is it that they're talking about? I don't recall having written any of this. And the Holy One, blessed be he, responds, well, then go back and there may be something you can learn.